Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This year marks the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer. Thousands of civil rights activists from the North went south, and many to conduct voter registration drives. They also established freedom schools in towns throughout Mississippi to address the racial inequalities in that state's educational system. It was dangerous work. The activists faced threats and harassment from white supremacist groups and local residents and police. 37 black churches, 30 black homes and businesses were firebombed or burned during that summer. Over 1,000 black and white volunteers were arrested. Many were beaten. And you'll recall that summer, three young civil rights workers, James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner, were murdered. And that made news all over the country. So did the voter registration drive. In 1965, the Voting Rights Act was passed, outlawing tactics that southern states had used to prevent blacks from voting. This summer, our two guests are going to be leading an absolutely fascinating tour. And the tour will be of southern museums, civil rights points of deep, deep interest, and it will be in honor of the Freedom Summer and in honor of the Freedom Rides and the civil rights action that took place during that very important decade. We have two guests with us in studio, Margaret Rozga, no stranger to our audience, I'm sure, civil rights activist, poet, professor of English emerita at UW-Waukesha. She worked on a Southern Christian Leadership Conference voter registration project in Alabama in 1965. She was a member of the 1967-68 Milwaukee NAACP Youth Council, participated in 200 nights of marching that helped secure passage of federal and local fair housing legislation here in Milwaukee. She's frequently returned to the South to tour civil rights historic sites and continues her work in many ways on social justice. Margaret, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah, our pleasure. Also joining us in studio is Jim O'Leary, and he teaches United States history and world history at Oconomowoc High School and has been teaching for a number of years now. He and Peggy will be leading the tour, tracing the Freedom Rides and honoring civil rights action. Jim, thank you so much for being with us.
That's my pleasure, Kathleen. Let's
just start with you for a moment, Jim. I was amazed when I was looking at your itinerary how many civil rights museums there are now in the South. It's one city after another, huh?
Well, and I think part of the importance of the trip is that we're going to get to see how it is presented in the South. I don't think there's any doubt the South has come to grips with its history. And I think we're really looking forward to being able to see that and to show others.
Yeah, I'm sure it should be a wonderful tour. Margaret, tell me about the decision you made to go to Alabama in 1965 as a young woman.
The decision came largely because of Freedom Summer the year before. Mm. I was sitting in the living room of the home where I was living with my family, my parents and my siblings, watching TV, seeing President Johnson send a unit of sailors out to look for the bodies of Michael Schwerner, James Cheney, and Andrew Goodman. I've watched Fannie Lou Hamer testify at the 1964 Democratic Convention about the difficulties. She was beaten and kicked off of the plantation where she had been working for a long time because she tried to register to vote. And that astounded me. I didn't know how that could be. This was America. What do you mean people can't vote? So I began to look for how I could get involved, be a contributor in turning that situation around.
Were you afraid at all? Did you know what you were going to encounter, or did you find out once you got there?
I consider myself a distinguished coward.
Well, I never thought of you that way, but I guess I'll consider you that way now, too.
I knew it would be a scary situation, and it proved, in fact, that it was. Actually, doing voter registration, going from residence to residence in a rural county in the South where houses are kind of clustered, but then there's a great distance from one cluster to another cluster. is either boring or terrifying.
Mm-hmm. I understand what you're saying.
Sort of like being a soccer goalie.
Yeah.
Right.
She's a poet, too. Did we say that? But I guess you can tell from her answer. How important was Freedom Summer and all of those voter registration drives, the schools that were built? How important was that black-white cooperation and challenge to the system? How important was that in getting major legislation passed in the 1960s?
Well, I think the biggest benefit was the reaction of the segregationists. Dr. King's philosophy was based on the peaceful resistance that would actually draw a reaction. And that, without that reaction and the media attention it brought, I don't think you get legislators. I don't think you get governors and presidents. And I don't think you get them as involved as when the media reports, here's a violent reaction to a reasonable, peaceful march or activity or action. Whether it's a boycott or the Freedom Rides or helping voter registration or a march, if those aren't met with the violent resistance of the segregationists, I'm not sure they have an impact.
Mm-hmm. And was it the murders of the three young civil rights workers, two of whom were white, which really got a lot of national attention, news attention? Did that turn the tide, do you think, Margaret, in getting the nation to pay attention to these issues?
I think it did. And it also raised questions for African Americans about how does the country perceive the value of their lives if when they were dredging the river in the area where Shorna Chaney and Goodman were killed, they pulled up bodies of African Americans that had been there a long time, and nobody had paid any attention to it. So it raised a question about, were white lives worth more than black lives? Certainly for African Americans, who had always suspected that was the attitude. But also white people of good conscience and, you know, there's something definitely wrong here. I think the Northern College students were invited to participate because organizers knew that there would be that effect. If mom and dad were worried about their child in Mississippi, their congressperson would hear about any difficulties. And in fact, the strategy was brilliant.
Mm-hmm. And you have the interesting historical perspective of working both in the North and in the South. I'm wondering, from a historical perspective, what was brewing in the North while Freedom Summer was going on in 1964?
Well, I think anybody who thinks that racism was limited to the South would be very misguided. But I think the civil rights movement caused such a threat to the livelihood of the segregationists in the South, that's where the reaction was the strongest. But there were race riots in the northern cities and states going back to World War II and before. So it wasn't like the North was coming to the rescue of the South in that regard. The Great Migration, which brought large numbers of blacks to the North to get jobs and housing, certainly created a stress that Northerners had not dealt with before. So I think it's all coming together at that time, and I don't know, other than maybe the severity and the magnitude, that things were very different in the North than they were in the South. Racism existed everywhere. But the rules of how blacks and whites related to each other were obviously different. If you go back to the mid 50s when Emmett Till was killed, because he didn't understand, he was from Chicago. He didn't understand that in Mississippi you're not allowed to interact. He may have faced racism. I'm sure he did face racism in Chicago, But in Chicago, he could interact with whites without fear of beatings or death. And that comes to light. That comes out as you know, Margaret said before, you know, what are the lives worth? Mm-hmm. And is there any difference?
Margaret, you were in 1965, worked on Southern Christian Leadership Conference voter registration drive project, then a member of the 1967-68 Milwaukee NAACP Youth Council, and participated in all of the hundreds of nights of marching that helped secure passage of fair housing in this city. So you have a real on-the-ground answer to this question of, was it a lot different in the South than it was in your hometown?
When we were working in the South, we were in Bullock County, Alabama, about 50 miles southeast of Montgomery, a rural county, cotton growing at the time. And almost every night we had a meeting at an African-American church. And to get from wherever the meeting was to the place the family we were staying with meant going through what we used to call beautiful downtown Midway. Midway, Alabama was about 500 people. There really wasn't a downtown, but there was an old cotton processing plant where teenagers hung out, white teenagers hung out. When we would drive past, they would get in their car and follow us.
Oh.
And the rule at the time was never let anybody pass you on the highway at night, because that's how Viola Liuzzo had been killed. Somebody pulled up alongside her and forced her off the road. So I would drive as fast as the car would go, which wasn't that fast, about 75 miles an hour.
That's pretty fast, Margaret.
Especially on a dark country, curvy road.
Yeah, right.
And there were no signs to indicate where you were. I knew the Daniels family was, their driveway was right after the third curve out of Midway. So I would count first curve, second curve, third curve, slam on the brakes, turn in the Daniels driveway. If I had missed that driveway, I would have had to keep going all the way to Florida.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, you know, when you read documents about life in the South at this time, the word terror comes up a lot. And it was a society controlled by terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing wasn't true in Milwaukee in that same personal sort of way. I wasn't followed as I drove home from marches or rallies in Milwaukee, although there was a point at which the police followed us everywhere we went. And I remember going to a play with somebody had given us free tickets to go to a play at what was then the Milwaukee Repertory Theater on the east side. And I was driving, and I dropped everybody off, and the police were following us. And I was afraid to drop off the last person and drive home alone because I didn't want to be arrested when nobody knew what was happening. So the person I was with knew his way around all the alleys and so on. And he said, turn here, turn here, turn here. And then we thought we lost them. Well, we came back around the corner, and there they were sitting in front of his house. So we sat there until they left, and then he went in, and I went home, and it was okay. So some of the same emotions were raised, but the circumstances under which they were raised and who was provoking that feeling it was a daily thing in the South. It was an occasional thing here.
Mm-hmm. We welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. This year marks the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer, and our guests this hour are leading a tour tracing the Freedom Rides, honoring civil rights actions at memorials and sites in many places in the South. They're going to be at the Lorraine Motel, where Martin Luther King was assassinated. They'll be at Medgar Evers Home Museum, Beth Israel Synagogue. We'll talk about the significance of that. At the opening ceremony of the National Civil Rights Convention, they're going to Selma, to Birmingham, to Atlanta, to Richmond, and to Washington. And so we'll talk a little bit about the tour as well. So did I give you the number? 800 416-8655, email talk at WPR.org, and our Facebook page. If you'd like to leave a message there, you certainly can do so, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer this year, and UW-Waukesha's continuing education department will be retracing their heroic journey and the heroic journey of many people in this country and in the South on their Freedom Rides. It's a 9-day journey to key cities encountered on the Freedom Ride, and our guests this hour are leading that tour, Margaret Rozga, civil rights activist, poet, professor of English emerita at UW-Waukesha. She was working to get people to vote in the South in Alabama in 1965 and was a member of the 67 to 68 Milwaukee NAACP Youth Council. First caller is Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Kathleen. I know the program is primarily about Freedom Summer, but to me, Freedom Summer speaks of the whole project at that time for blacks in Mississippi to hold a, they held almost like a fake vote, I guess, in order to indicate how much they wanted to vote if they weren't operating under terror and intimidation. And I'm wondering what your guests have to say about current policy in the United States that disenfranchises so many people. The Sentencing Project estimates that anywhere from 4 to 6 million Americans are disenfranchised because of felony convictions, and even after they're off parole and off paper, they're in many places, they're not allowed to vote. And then also, here in Wisconsin and elsewhere, we have this movement that suggests that there's such widespread voter fraud and that we need IDs and we have to have all kinds of documentation in order to vote. And I'm wondering, as your guests reflect on America coming to terms with its racial history, what they have to say about the work that needs to be done now in the United States of America.
Good areas for us to talk about. Thank you, Rich, for the call. Margaret?
Yes, thank you. It's the whole right to vote issue continues to be immensely important to me. This is how I got my start in civil rights. In 1965, the Voting Rights Act was passed, and it immediately made a difference in the county where we were working. The petty harassment that voting registrars were doing to people who African Americans wanted to register to vote stopped, not because we had federal registrars in our county, but because they were in the state and they could come to the county. So it made an immense difference. And at the time, I thought, oh, that problem is solved. Now we can go on to something else. And this, seeing the many dimensions of the problem, and efforts to begin the process of disenfranchising lots of people is a road I do not want to see us go down. There is a racial dimension to the particular aspect of that problem that you raise, and that is that African Americans are incarcerated at a much greater rate than whites. And if you lose your right to vote, that's a way of disenfranchising African Americans. I'm not sure I understand why you can't, you know, I have yet to hear somebody offer a rationale of why you can't vote after you've served your time. So I think that's important. But I also think that we need to be alert to all of the other efforts there are to disenfranchise people, cutting out early voting, making it more difficult to register. There are people who are, given the fact of low-wage minimum jobs, are at work before 7 o'clock and still at work in the evening. And so the attempt to cut out early voting on weekends disenfranchises people. And I think the Freedom Summer and the Civil Rights Movement of the 60s pointed us in a direction that we want to continue moving in, not that we want to back away from. So I think the issue you raise is very important, and I often speak to it, and I think we do have to be alert to it.
Jim, what do you see as the civil rights issues that you talk about with your students in 2014?
It scares me that people want to limit the access to vote of citizens of the United States for whatever it is, whether it used to be a poll tax or a literacy test or grandfather clauses. I think the voter fraud issue is fake. It's not a real – has certainly would have the potential to be a real problem, but it's not a problem. And a bigger problem, I think, is taking actions that restrict the access to vote from citizens. Constitution does not – I don't believe the Constitution empowers the government to do that. And it wasn't right. It wasn't right to deny that right or access to the polls to blacks. It isn't right to do that now. I think it's one of the reasons this trip's so important is because that there are parts of this history that our history there it's not over. Mm-hmm. History doesn't end. Mm-hmm. And this is I think this is an example of it continuing. The struggle to keep to protect a pretty basic fundamental sacred right to be able to vote and to register and to be involved in the process. I don't see a difference from the way they tried to restrict voting in the past.
Thanks, Rich, for the call. Let's go next to Earl in Wausau. Hi, Earl.
Hello?
Hi, Earl. You're on the road. I don't know if we can hear you, but let's try. Hi, Earl.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you today?
I'm all right. Go right ahead, sir.
I was just wondering, you know, how your guest had said that it was acts of terrorism and that it... Should we go that far, or was it more acts of ignorant people?
Well, I think what you're talking about is maybe cause, and what I'm talking about when I use the word terrorism is effect. So it can be both. It can be somebody acting out of ignorance and having the effect of terrorizing the person who is on the receiving end of their action.
Mm-hmm. Well, and some of the actions really had this terrorist element to them, too, the way the Klan would operate in the South and, God, all the lynchings that took place. I mean, those were acts. It's hard to say that they weren't terrorist acts, really.
Right. Actually, I'm working on a project right now developing curriculum for high school students to study the civil rights history. And as I'm looking at the historical documents, the word terrorist is used over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think anybody that uses violence and intimidation, and that's clearly how the segregationists were acting, is the threat of violence was pervasive, as was the violence. I don't know that that means that all terrorists are ignorant, but like Margaret said, it's a cause. You know, I think we might be talking about cause and effect. And but I have no trouble categorizing what happened in the South as terror because of the use of intimidation and violence when it was blatant.
Yeah. Thanks, Earl, for your call. Suzanne in Waukesha, hello.
Hi. I'm really having a hard time trying to decide which story to tell. I know I screamed. I was born in Mississippi in 1959, and my parents were young adults in Mississippi during this period of time. And I grew up on stories like one of Dad's professors from Ole Miss being knocked out by a mocktail cocktail when James Meredith tried to get into Mississippi, the first black admitted to Mississippi. Another story of a friend having a cross burned on his yard after he went to have supper at a black family's home. Mm. And my mother, when we finally moved to the Midwest, saying she was never so glad to leave the South because she was afraid my dad was going to get shot with his opinions, which you know, the gentleman before was questioning the word terrorist, but, you know, people, you just didn't do certain things. You couldn't say certain things. Certain people were, you know, not allowed to do things. I mean, it was a climate of fear.
And did your family feel more comfortable when they moved to, was it Wisconsin, Suzanne?
We actually moved to Iowa.
Oh.
And the funny thing, I have to say no.
Really? Why?
Because, yes and no.
Okay.
Because we encountered Southern prejudice. I had a horrible first year with being teased with my accent and that I wore dresses more than the girls here, and I was culture shock.
Oh, my.
But I also encountered reverse sort of terrorism, prejudice. Like, I remember a girl asking me if I liked this one girl, I'll call her Julie, and I said no. And she says, well, you have to like her, she's black. And I said, no, she's not very nice to me, I don't like her. You know? It doesn't matter what color she is.
Thank you very much for your call. Isn't that interesting? Her father, teaching at Ole Miss, was worried he was going to get shot for his opinions.
One of the largest Freedom Summer projects in 1964 was in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, which is where University of Southern Mississippi is located. And in some of the historical documents about faculty from Mississippi Southern, it was called at the time, talk about their wanting to invite some of the students and some of some of the local people whom they hadn't had any contact with before to dinner, just a social event. And some of them did, but they said, please come after dark.
Oh, my.
As they didn't want anybody to know who they were having in their homes.
Wow. Tell me just a little bit, because we have a ton of phone calls. Thank you, Suzanne, for your call. We'll go back to them momentarily. When I looked at your itinerary, I was unaware there were so many civil rights museums in the South. They're all over the place now. Can you give me just a highlight of those that you're going to see and why you chose them? Jim?
Well, we're actually going to start in Memphis. We're taking the Freedom Ride, basically, which was in 1961, in reverse, and for logistical reasons. But we're going to start in Memphis, which has the National Civil Rights Museum. I don't know how many National Civil Rights Museums there are, but that's what it's called in Memphis, and it's at the Lorraine Motel. I think each of them represent, and while I think they all teach the civil rights movement and its history. They all have a reason because of this something specific that's happened. I used to have my students, they had to identify the cities of the civil rights. When we studied the civil rights unit, we also included a map, and they had to be able to map, not a trip, but they had to know by location what happened. What happened in Little Rock? What happened in Memphis? What happened in Montgomery, Selma, Birmingham, Anniston, Greensboro, Jackson? They had to know location, and they had to know what happened. And I think that's why how many World War II locations and museums are there in Asia and Europe? There's something, if something major and specific happened, they're going to honor that memory and preserve that history.
Mm-hmm. Jim is right about the starting point in Memphis and the national character of the museum that was created from the Lorraine Motel where Martin Luther King was killed. It is a great place to start because it does give an overview. It's not just about civil rights in Memphis. It is about the whole Southern Civil Rights Museum. So when we're there, we'll sort of have a preview of some of the other stops that we're making. The museum in Selma is a voting rights museum. It's much smaller. It has the advantage of being located very close to the Edmund Pettus Bridge, where marchers were beaten on Bloody Sunday when they were trying to march from Selma to Montgomery. One of the things about that museum that really impressed me is they at least the last time I was there, which is 10 years ago. But they had a wall that was just labeled, I was there, and they had post-it notes. So anybody who had been on the march could write their experience. And the fact that so many people were involved and they each saw it a little bit differently and felt something different. The one that impressed me the most was very simple. It was a couple of sentences. It was, I was a high school student. I participated in the demonstrations and the march. For that, I was expelled from school. I never finished high school.
Oh, my goodness.
And I wanted to cry.
Yeah.
The one in Montgomery, there might be several in Montgomery, but there is a museum right at or near the bus stop where Rosa Parks got on the bus. And the thing that I remember about that museum was they had a replica of the bus, and you could get on and you would hear the bus driver saying, move back, move back. And you'd hear crowd noise, so you could feel like you were there.
Mm-hmm.
You want to talk about the one in Birmingham?
Why don't you hold? Let's get to it. Birmingham, I'll remember.
Okay.
Think about it. We'll get there in a couple minutes. So, let's go to a few more phone calls. We have so many of them coming in. John in Milwaukee is next. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi.
Talking about Martin Luther King, he was assassinated. Now they had a trial by the King family, and it was the jury was convinced that it was not named person that did it, but it was a government operation, and a Memphis policeman did kill him.
Well, we hate to believe that people who we love died, and there will be theories about who killed Martin Luther King and who killed Abraham Lincoln and who killed John Kennedy. And why do we hold to that, do you think? Jim, the history professor?
This is just my idea, but sometimes it's hard to come to grips that our heroes are killed by the way they are killed.
Right.
I can't tell you that I know, but I can tell you what I believe to be true. Two summers ago, I read a book called Hellbound on His Trail. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but it is about James Earl Ray stalking Dr. King. I guess until evidence comes forward, real hard evidence comes forward, I think James Earl Ray did it. Whether he was funded by somebody else, again, you'd need evidence,
right?
Some evidence of that. I think just the way he was caught, James Earl Ray was arrested at Heathrow Airport in London, trying to get to Rhodesia, where he knew he would be free at the time in 1968. His trip to Rhodesia was taking so long because he didn't have the funds to do it. And he was a petty burglar and a robber. And that's how he got caught. Had he been funded by others, he would have been in Rhodesia long before he was captured, in my view of things, based on things that I've read. But I do think we hold on to conspiracies because sometimes the truth is difficult to accept. Mm-hmm. Now, present the other evidence to me, and I will not hesitate to change my mind.
Right. Thanks very much, John, for the call. We'll take more phone calls momentarily. We're talking about Freedom Summer 50 years ago this summer, and our guests are going to be leading a tour sponsored by the UW-Waukesha Continuing Education Department that retraces the journey kind of in reverse on the Freedom Ride. They're going on a 9-day journey to key cities, and it's taking place when? June 17th?
13th to 21st.
June 13th to the 21st. If you want more information, it's on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. There's a link to this if you're interested in signing up. It's sure to be It's sure to be one good trip. Jim O'Leary teaches United States history and world history at Oconomowoc High School. And Peggy Rozga, civil rights activist, poet, professor of English emerita at UW-Waukesha. She worked on voter registration project in Alabama in 65 and was a member of the 67 to 68 Milwaukee NAACP Youth Council. Can I give you the number? 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Email has come in for you, Margaret. Karen from Prairie du Chien wants to know more about Father Grappi's role in the Voting Rights Act and the civil rights of that day.
Father Grappi was inspired by the Southern Civil Rights Movement and went south to participate in actions many times. He was at Selma and did the Selma to Montgomery march even before civil rights became a national issue with coverage on nightly news. He had gone south with several other priests and had visited parishes where priests were doing what they could to deal with the situations in which they found themselves. He had asked to be assigned to St. Boniface in the African American community when he was first ordained. He had directed a summer camp in the housing project area as a seminarian, and that was the other inspiration for him. He became very close to some families and wanted to continue that work.
All right, let's go to John in Rhinelander. Hi.
Hi. It seems now we have a different group attacking voting rights. We've got the American Legislative Exchange Council that proposes these attacks in state after state, trying to restrict voting, voter ID laws, and restricting the time period in which you can vote. Before it was violent hate groups. Now it's this well-funded corporate effort. It seems to be even more effective somehow. What do you think of this?
I'm not sure that the well-funded organizations is new in fighting or resisting civil rights issues. It may just be the absence of the violence now or less violence than that makes that more obvious. But I think resistance to integration was always well funded. Not long after, in fact, very shortly, immediately after the Brown versus Board of Education, 101 Southern congressmen signed a manifesto encouraging people to ignore and resist the Supreme Court decision. So that wasn't the violent action, but it sure was a bold, where legislators were defying and encouraging people to defy a Supreme Court decision. So I'm not sure that what we're seeing today, it's not genius, and I don't know that it's even that new. Margaret might have...
My answer would be along the same lines. And, speaking of voting rights, one of the features of this tour is going will swing through the South and then head north through Virginia to Washington, D.C. And Congressman Sensenbrenner has been cooperative with us in terms of arranging things in Washington, D.C. And he is one of the people who almost immediately after the Supreme Court ruling that nullified part of the 1965 Voting Rights Act said, well, we need this protection and let's rewrite the law in a way that will meet the objections of the Supreme Court to the current law. So I'm also glad to see that push back to the curtailment of voting rights from all kinds of sources. And I guess my orientation is forward-looking, that I want to say, okay, this is what we need to do. How are we going to make it happen? Let's get to work on making that happen.
One more thought on that. Malcolm X once warned that we have to be careful that the media doesn't make us blame the oppressed for the problems that the sympathies are taken away from those that are oppressed. And if that was happening in his time, and he was assassinated in 1964, I believe, if that was happening in his time, the fact that it might be happening today, that there are groups trying to make oppressed people look to be the troublemakers and not the victims, that wouldn't be new.
Thank you very much for the call. Yeah, the more we talk about this, what a decade this was. Holy Toledo, so much was taking place, wasn't it? And it was such a tragic time, and it changed so many people's lives, and people died. And
right.
Oh,
yeah.
My.
I have been asked, why this trip? Why do we want to go south? And I think that the extent to which the civil rights movement of the 1960s had an impact on life in the United States, we've only begun to acknowledge some of the contributions of the ordinary, extraordinary heroes who were putting their lives on the line day by day, and so on. And so I think it's important to pick up on that. And if something, I think we get our sense of what's possible from history. If it's been done before, it can be done again. And I think the previous caller was right, that there is a formidable enemy, a formidable opponent of democracy in this country, in the American Legislative Exchange Council. And if we study what went on in the South and how organizing to get voting rights then can help us understand how to protect those rights today.
We go next to Eugene and Viola. Hi.
Good afternoon, Kathleen, and to your guests. In 1990, I hooked up with an outfit to go south and set pine for the winter down south. And they put me on a crew down in Louisiana. And one afternoon, it was raining and we couldn't plant. And we weren't too far from the small town, small city of Goldana. So I drove into town and I was looking for a shopping center. And I stopped at a small business there, and I was asking directions, talking to a black. And a couple of white people chimed in, and the black automatically shut his mouth and turned around and walked away. And I thought, Lordy, in some parts of the South, things still have not changed. And that had only been 25 years since the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah, I think that's another reason to do the trip. Every time I've gone South, there's been some serendipitous happening that helped clarify both what had changed and improved and what had not. For example, one of my daughters went to Tulane University, and so I was driving her to school or driving home. And anyway, I stopped at a gas station on the highway, an old 1950s-style gas station with the restrooms on the outside. And bought some gas and then went in and paid and picked up the key to the women's room. And the cashier said to me, "That's women's?" And I had no idea what she was saying.
What she was talking about. Right?
And so I said, "Well, that's what I am." And I went to use the bathroom. When I saw how disgusting it was, I realized it came back to me, oh, white women are ladies.
Oh, my.
And I didn't understand the code.
Right.
But, yeah, you do pick up on some things that nobody in a class would think to tell you.
Right. Right. And you broke that code, didn't you? Yeah. Thanks, Eugene, very much for the call. Ray in Milwaukee. Hello, Ray.
Yeah, good afternoon. I want to connect the anti-war demonstrations in Milwaukee and Madison at the same time with the civil rights demonstrations in Milwaukee, because Father Grappi was a huge moving force here, and he would march from the inner city of Milwaukee to the south side, and the groups he was with would be met with bricks and bottles, so we were called the Selma of the North. You know, we were a horrible, and we still are a horribly segregated city. I want to admit that. But I want to give people out there in Radio Land a feeling for what it was like to be a kid back then and to be out in the streets in Milwaukee when all of this stuff was happening. The air was absolutely electric. I was 8, 9, 10 years old during this period, and I want to describe two moments that really stand out in my mind. One, I was with my grandmother and my sister, either at a Salvation Army or at a Goodwill store, and it might have been 12th and Belize or somewhere out there. I'm not sure. I was such a young kid. But there was a large group of African Americans coming down the street and tearing up everything, and it was about, you know, the segregation in this city and about not being able to live on the south side of Milwaukee at that time. And when they came past us, my grandmother just stood back in the doorway, and we were absolutely unharmed by what went past, but I was kind of freaked out by it, and in the end, they hadn't harmed us at all. They went past us. I don't believe they even touched that store, because maybe they realized that store is for poor folk, and that's where we all go, you know. We were a white family that lived on food stamps at that time, too. And then to be on the east side of Milwaukee, when students would come from Marquette University, is where they would start their march, the hippies would join in, and by the time they reached Prospect Avenue, it was, you know, they were tearing stuff up. They were angry, and it was mostly about the anti-war. But it was all connected with civil rights, because you would see black folk in there with them, too.
All right, Ray, let's get a response. Margaret?
Well, I don't know the anti-war marches that you're talking about. And it seems as though you're describing the open housing marches when you're talking about the ones near 12th and Valit. And actually, this is kind of a major issue for me, that a lot of people will say, oh, 1967 in Milwaukee, I remember that, that there was year of the riots, plural. Mm-hmm. And it is true that there was a disturbance on 3rd Street at the end of July in 1967. Some people debate whether that was fits the classical definition of a riot or not, but I'm willing to grant that was a riot. But if you're going to talk about riots, plural, in Milwaukee in 1967, then you have to talk about the two white riots on the south side when open housing marchers across the 16th Street Viaduct to go to Kosciuszko Park. My clearest memory of those marches is being in Kosciuszko Park. There were about 200 of us that first night, open housing supporters, and about 8,000 counter demonstrators. So we were outnumbered like 40 to 1. And a police officer came up to us huddled around a picnic table in Kosciuszko Park and said, "Father, would you say your prayer or whatever it is you want to do here? And then let's get out, because we can't hold them." So by the police admission, the whites on the south side, the so-called counter demonstrators, were out of control. A crowd of people out of control is a riot. But that's not the image that most people have in their mind. They don't see white people when you use the word riot. But that would be what was happening in Milwaukee in 1967. As far as I'm concerned, the riot on 3rd Street in Milwaukee was a mere interruption in the open housing campaign.
We're almost out of time. I want to make sure that we let people know when this tour is taking place, the dates again, and the link is on our Facebook page.
It's June 13th to the 21st summer, 2014.
And have you done one of these before?
I have not.
Have you, Margaret?
I've done it with friends, and well, the first one I did was with my daughter, and I've done some with friends, and I've been back south since that summer of 1965, probably about 10 times.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you both so much for being with us, and it sounds like it's going to be a really fascinating tour. I'm sure you're going to travel with a group of people who will just enjoy each other's company and enjoy the history.
Thanks, Kathleen.
That's a good thing.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Our thanks to Margaret Rozga, civil rights activist, poet, professor of English emerita at UW-Waukesha. She was registering people to vote in Alabama in 1965, and in 1967-68 was with the Milwaukee NAACP Youth Council. She has done all kinds of social justice work in the years since then. Jim O'Leary teaches United States history and world history at Oconomowoc High School, been teaching for a number of years, and will also be one of the tour leaders tracing the Freedom Rides and honoring civil rights action at memorials and sites in key southern cities, and it's all taking place this June. So that's about it for us today. Thank you to KP Whaley for producing this program and for doing all the on-air production as well. And thanks to you for your many calls. We're with you again tomorrow, 1 until 3. Great conversations coming up here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.